figures.
I notice you have a book there that looks...
Yes.
That looks interesting.
I might refer to it.
Therapy of Spiritual Illnesses.
This is Volume 3, Therapy of Spiritual Illnesses, An Introduction to the Ascetic Tradition of the Orthodox Church, an extremely expensive set of three books that I bought after much anxiety, almost as much anxiety as I displayed when I did not buy that pipe that I wanted this past week. And I got them in the end, and so I have them. And I'm going to use them for a particular purpose. Okay, I have a note to start on, and it could be wrong, but...
I got a page mark for it again.
Okay, what page is it?
On 26, Revealing the Passions. I thought we were going to start there next.
Ah, yes, right here in my book it says, next, with the circle around it. On page 26, Revealing the Passions. Okay. When we're indulging the passions, we don't notice them. But this person that speaks to Saint Paisios, to Elder Paisios, says to him, Yeronda, Elder, I am troubled by my passions. And he says, good. A person who acknowledges his passions humbles himself. So you're supposed to be troubled by your passions. It reminds me of what Father Thomas Hopko said when someone was asking him about whether or not a person who has desire for a person of the same sex be comfortable in the Orthodox Church. And he told them, do you remember what he told them? What did he say?
If I remember right, he said, I'm not sure anyone should feel comfortable in the Orthodox Church. or he may have said it differently than that.
No, I think that's what he said.
Are you comfortable in the Orthodox Church?
I mean, I go up to communion.
We could change things to make ourselves comfortable. And then we wouldn't notice our passions.
Yeah.
Everything would be fine. And the best way to make yourself comfortable in the church, I think, is to just think of, well, we are fallen. There's nothing that we can do. All we can do is ask God to accept us as we are. You know, it's this very popular hymn. It's a very beautiful hymn, and it's been, they sang it at both of my parents' funerals.
Mine too.
And then yours too, and everybody sings it, and it's Amazing Grace, and the folkies love it. Everybody can agree on this music, you know. And it's about a God accepting me just as I am, right? Save a wretch like me, you know, once I was lost, now I'm found. And it expresses the idea that there is nothing that I can do. And after that, we're comfortable. Because we're sinful and there's nothing we can do. We are positive as Orthodox Christians that there is that if we don't make an effort, God won't help us. A person who acknowledges his passions humbles himself. And a person says, but I get upset over constantly making mistakes. Well, if you notice that you make mistakes. A person who doesn't notice that they're making mistakes is prideful and, you know, and just thinks it's all other people. And Elder Paisios responds, you should be glad at being constantly wrong. You have pride, and this is how you're humbled. Don't despair. Whenever we make a mistake, our real self is revealed, and we have the opportunity for humility. And humility is where we're supposed to be at. It is, it's progress. It's exactly the kind of progress that within our pride we're not interested in. Our real self is revealed. We come to know our real self, and we try to correct ourselves and not live with the false impression that we are doing well. Sometimes people say, I've even heard it in confession, I think I'm doing better than I was a year ago, you know. And I thought, well, guess not. Or that's not what you'd think. I am glad when a weakness of mine displays itself, and that way you can deal with it, when my passions sprout up. If they didn't, then I would have thought that I had become holy. When you get angry or you censure someone, be grieved, but also be glad, because your weakness was made manifest, which will then prompt you to struggle to be delivered from it. Now, these are all things that we have to do. This is the way to proceed. And it echoes what we heard from Archimandrite Simeon, Craig Yiopoulos, in our book, Do You Know Yourself? So what Elder Paisios is saying is that we come to know ourselves by noticing the things that we do that we ought not to have done. And that way we can correct ourselves. We've got something to work on, something specific to work on. Top of page 27, be careful. If you know some passion is hidden inside of you, look for it. Oops, I'm keeping you from seeing the book.
No, that's fine.
You even have your own, noticed it. You had your own underlines in there. That was good. I think they were yours.
Yep.
Be careful if you know that some passion is hidden inside of you. We take notes. Sometimes people take notes, they think, and they prepare for confession, and they come with notes, sometimes extensive notes, and they confess these things that they want to be forgiven of. And then when they go home, they take that piece of paper and crumple it up and throw away. But that piece of paper is helpful. You know, we should remember, once we know some passion is hidden inside of us, it's during the day, during the week, between then and the next confession. That's when we need those notes that we've made, because it's a nice list of all the passions that we're supposed to work on. And later on, Elder Poesios talks about how we should focus on the big ones. So we should look at the things we've confessed, prioritize them, and focus on the big ones, because he says if you can uproot the big ones, the little ones all come up along with it. So that's it's a matter of knowing what we ought to be trying to deal with, and then we can struggle with it. And then when God sees us struggling with it, he will help us. He will do the part that we can't do. If we don't struggle with it, we just confess this sin and say, well, God forgives me for it, and then we just don't make any effort, then nothing is going to happen. Well, so if we know this passion is hidden inside of us, look for it in case it comes out and bites you. That's what happens during the week when all of a sudden we're angry. It's not dangerous to know the snake is there. There's no danger in knowing the snake is there. Be aware so you can kill it. So this snake is a snake that can be killed. And if we try, if we struggle, we make that effort, then God will respond and do the part that we can't do. It's dangerous when a person doesn't keep track of himself. We come to confession in order to keep track of ourselves. We don't just come to confession in order to confess that we've broken this rule, that rule, and the other rule. God forgives us, and then we're fine. If we did the things that we confessed, there must be something going on inside of us that caused us to do those things. And so awareness of those things is something valuable that we take away from confession, so that we can use that awareness. When one is aware of his passions and carries out the necessary struggle, then Christ helps him to uproot them. And carries out the necessary struggle is important. If we go to confession and then feel like, okay, now I'm clean, I'm fine, that's the end of that. No, and we stop struggling. And then the next time we do it, we want to hurry back to confession and quick confess it again because we did it again. No, we're not supposed to do that. We're supposed to struggle with it. We confessed it in confession, so we know it's there. Struggle and leave it all to God, but struggle. You ought to examine yourself to see where you are, what you are doing. As soon as a person begins to see his weaknesses, he must feel the good restlessness. There's a whole section near the back of the book where he focuses on good restlessness. We'll get to that before we know it. Well, as soon as a person begins to see his weaknesses, he must feel the good restlessness. I need to do something about it. I have a good example of good restlessness, only it's not about struggling with my sins. It's Sharon was saying, whenever there's something hanging over my head, I can't sleep. And this morning I couldn't because, you know, I came back from Chicago Monday and I had to wrap up the courses that I teach at Blue Ridge. Didn't have as near as many students as I used to. Requirements have changed. It's impacted my number of students. But still, I had essays to read and grades to make sure that everybody was getting their best possible grade from the quizzes that they took. And I wasn't finished last night when I went to bed, and I knew I had to have my grades in this afternoon at 3 o'clock. You know, and last night I went to bed, I was totally exhausted, woke up at 3:15, tried to tell myself, look, there's plenty of time, go back to sleep. And I had something very much like what Elder Paisios is talking about. I don't know if it was a good restlessness, maybe it was a bad restlessness. But I know about the restlessness. If there is something that I've left undone, I have this restlessness. I can't sleep until I deal with it. And that's the kind of thing he's talking about, only he's applying it to dealing with our weaknesses. And, you know, if I had good restlessness come over me when I was trying to keep from engaging in my gluttony, that would be a good thing, you know. that's not what comes over me when I know. I said, you know, is that what I shouldn't eat this? And I, you know, it just sounds so good, and it tastes wonderful. And it's not a good restlessness, it's just complete capitulation. You must feel the good restlessness come over you in order to struggle and correct them. If you don't have this good restlessness, you're not going to struggle. So we need to learn to do that. That's what we do between confessions. We don't just try to keep from breaking the rule. We have to struggle. I must examine myself. We go to confession. Recognize that I have certain weaknesses. Not that I've broken this particular one rule, or done this or done that, but examine yourself. What weakness is it? What do I need to work on so that I don't keep doing those things? And undertake, struggle to correct these weaknesses. And again, you examine yourself, check, see how you've done. Have I corrected any of these weaknesses? And I say when I pray, because I've made this struggle, this effort, and in this condition of good restlessness, we pray and we say, my Lord, I'm doing all I can. And the question is, are we? If we don't have this good restlessness, if we don't have a desire to confront and deal with these things, and if we're not struggling with them, then we're not doing all we can, because we can do that. That's the part we can do. You know, we can't get rid of it. We can't pull it out. Maybe we don't have the strength to do that. But we have to want to pull it out. My Lord, I'm doing all I can, but you must help me rectify myself. Make me as I ought to be, because I cannot do it alone. And that's definitely the case. We can't do it alone. And if later on it's going to say, if God left us do it alone, then we'd be prideful. I mean, I was proud of myself once when I lost all the weight I was supposed to lose when I first found out that I had diabetes, and I was afraid I was going to die or have my foot cut off or lose my vision, all of which are things that are possible. And so I made this incredible effort, you know, incredible strength of will, all self-dependent. I don't remember praying. You know, it was my accomplishment. And, you know, and I got down to a weight that I hadn't been for I don't know how long. And I felt great, you know. And I was all came back, but I'd done it. I proved that I could do it. And it was me that did it. It was my will. This is not spiritually helpful. You know, you get prideful, and, you know, there's no real spiritual change. It's not about being able to keep from doing all those things by force of will. If it was, if that were the way things are, then maybe the legalistic way of thinking about confession, where, well, I broke a rule, I'm so ashamed, I'm better than this. That's what people think, that's what we think. I'm embarrassed because I know I'm better than this, you know, and so God forgive me for having, you know, not been as good as I know I can be. I have the willpower to do better. Well, whatever you're doing, it hasn't got anything to do with Christian spiritual life. It doesn't have anything to do with dependence ultimately on God. It doesn't have anything to do with synergy, cooperation with God, because cooperation with God always begins with our spiritual effort, 9 times out of 10, to do exactly the things that our ego or our love of self had no interest in doing. That's part of it. We'll come to this business of self soon. And before we get there, we're going to be in this next section. I could read this sensitive business. This is very touchy. I think I'm going to jump over this and come back to it when we come to it later on. I've got the page marked because it's hard to get a grip on that. We're on page 28 at the top, and this business about a person being overly sensitive. God does not allow him to recognize his passions all at once. And this business, why is a person, well, now I'm talking about it anyway. See, I have so little self-control, it's pitiful. But a person who is overly sensitive is going to be a person who is prideful and self-reliant. And a person like that, God will not, if we're like that, then God will not let us recognize our passions all at once. Because one or two things can happen. We can successfully, by our own strength of will, without God, force ourselves to do as we ought to do and think very badly, usually, about all those people who aren't doing what they ought to do. Maybe, you know, I'm going to go off on a tangent here and say things I shouldn't, so I'm not going to do that. So that's one thing. The other possibility that we fall into despair. And then some people who are prideful and very and super sensitive, you know, or sensitive about the, what do people think of me, and this is, you know, the other possibility other than being able to just bear down and accomplish not doing what we ought not to do by our strength of will, by our own will without God, the other possibility is despair. It figures. And we can swing back and forth. Despair. Oh, I did it again. So embarrassing. I'm better than this. Next week, you know, like 2 months later, we can come back to confession. And what we really want to say is, gee, I did so much better this last couple of weeks, this last month. You know, I'm really making progress. And, you know, it's all a state of delusion. First it's pride, and then it's despair. I mean, despair is the other side of disappointed pride. So that's pretty much what it boils down to. And such a person is overly sensitive, and sometimes scrupulous too. We'll get to scrupulousness. The defender of the passions is pride. This is how we defend our passions. Passions are those things that I, you know, and I've had to read all these essays, you know, by young men and young women, mostly young men and young women. There may be some older people in there too, but not too many. And they all have learned who they are from reading anime comics and going to Batman movies and identifying with, you know, all of these fictional characters, and, you know, and watching television, and they have, you know, and your passions and desires are who you are. That's who they think they are, and they all want to defend their passions and desires, and so they're in a complete state of spiritual delusion, and it's all about pride, and, you know, use pride to defend whatever your passions happen to be. We should have I don't know why they don't have a glutton's pride parade. It seems a natural thing to me. When all of the overweight people in America finally have enough of this oppressiveness and go out and get into the street and carry signs and say, fat is beautiful, you know, and just throw off these shackles.
We wouldn't do that because that would be like exercise.
Well, that's true. Well, we could maybe get mopeds or something. That's true. That would defeat the purpose. So, well, but it would be very much an American thing to do, you know. So be pridefully defend your passions. You know, there's nothing more American than that. When a soul is struggling for years, what is happening? We struggle for years, no progress, just the way we were before. When we don't see progress in our struggle, it means that that either we're not vigilant and we're just missing, you know, things that are just getting by us, or God doesn't let us advance anymore so that we won't be harmed by becoming prideful. And then Elder Paisio, St. Paisio says, explains to us that in response to the question, what is going to happen to me because I seem to be getting worse every day? Well, this person is good, he told them, because you're acknowledging your passions and humbling yourself. But he said he wants to explain to them, look, this is the way it is. There are three stages. The first stage, God gives us candy, sweets. Remember in past books by Elder Paisios, he would talk about giving people sweets himself. God gives out caramels and chocolates because he sees the need and the weakness of the soul. Just to, you know, to get us started, we need something sweet in the beginning. The second stage, God slightly removes his grace for training purposes. It's like training wheels, so that you use the training wheels, and you need those because you say, well, you know, it's God's help is your training wheels, in other words, or like when a father or a mother is helping their child. This is maybe a better example. Learn to ride a bike, and they have their hand, you know, on their shoulder or to help them steady them, and the child, you know, realizes that hand is there, and then he removes his hand, you know, and you're actually going a bit on your own, and then the next thing, bang, you fall over, and you realize that you need those training wheels, you need the helping hand, you know, of God. So it's actually the person who falls over learns more than the person who just, you know, rides off into the wild blue yonder all by himself. So again, it's a kind of a counter, it's an opposite kind of example. In spiritual life is not about self-reliance and learning to go it alone. It's about realizing that you cannot go it alone unless you are doing things in a way that doesn't have anything to do with God. I mean, it's we don't have the ability to be like Christ without God. That's the whole point, you know. That's why he came and became one of us, so that he could give us that kind of help from within our humanity, you know, in a very, very intimate kind of way. We cannot accomplish even the least, and must therefore humble ourselves and feel the need to take refuge in him. That's the second stage. The third stage is a permanent and steadfast good spiritual state. Well, we may never see that. I remember Herman gave a good talk up in Greenville talking about how the vast majority of us will never, never reach the point that Elder Paisios did, you know. And that's okay, just so long as we're making the effort. And in this case, Elder Paisios tells this person, you seem to be somewhere between the second and third stages. That's good. I mean, we've gone beyond the point where we're dependent on the sweets. God isn't giving me any sweets, that's it, forget it. The second stage, we're making an effort and we're beginning to realize that we can't do it on our own, that's good. So we're in the second stage, moving toward the third stage. You advance a little, but this person goes back and forth. And then you forget about your weakness again, because you're doing okay. So you forget your weakness and your need for God's help. And Christ removes his grace. And when we're deprived of divine grace, we see our weakness and begin to recover. Just exactly the opposite of what we expect. We people who think that Christianity is about God helping us to be able to become a better person so that we have more strength to live on our own without God, that's some other religion. It's pagan religion, basically. You know, the pre-Greek, to be Greek ever since St. Paul converted the Greeks, and the Greeks became more and more understanding of Christianity during the following 500 to 700 years. Now, to be Greek is to, I mean, really, the heart and soul of being Greek is to be a Christian. But it wasn't always that way. Before the Greeks were Christians, they depended on the pagan self-reliance of Aristotle, you know, and his teaching about ethics and the building of character, you know, the strong character of the individual. Americans believe in that to a large degree. Christianity is not about building an independent, strong, self-reliant character without God. We have to struggle, we have to make the effort, but in the struggling and making the effort that's necessary, we'll learn by that, that if we are trying to be Christ-like, we are not going to be able to make it. We have to have God's help. So the virtues are different than the pagan virtues. You know, they're not self-reliant virtues of character. They're virtues that can only come by our communion with God. So that's a significant difference, I think. If you had said to me, Elder Poesios says to the person, if you had said to me that as you advance you are becoming better, then I would have been scared. Pride, self-reliance. For I would have seen that you have become prideful. But now that you say you see yourself getting worse, I am glad, for I see that you are well. The more progress we make in humility, the more we will be able to realize how short in stature we are. Do not fear. The more one advances, the more he is able to detect his weaknesses and his imperfections. And that is progress, to be able to see our weaknesses, our imperfections more clearly. That's progress, because you're going to have enough humility to be able to implore God to help you to push this. Later on, he talks about, you know, if a child is struggling to push a heavy stone, who wouldn't go and help the child? That's the situation. I'm going to go down here to this paragraph 1, 2, 3, down from where we were reading. When there is no danger of becoming conceited and prideful, then God will certainly help. If we think we're starting to do better, then he withdraws his help. We go off on our own, and we, you know, think we don't need God. We may think we've made progress. Well, we have, but in the wrong kind of way. The good God desires that we all be delivered from our passions. If we have pride or the predisposition to become prideful, then he does not help us to be delivered from our passions, for then we will imagine that we achieved it without his help. When we pray with all our heart for God to deliver us from a particular passion, and he does not help, then we must immediately understand that behind this passion, an even greater passion is hidden, and that passion is pride. And he's not going to help us to grow in pride by helping us to deal with our gluttony, or whatever it happens to be, whatever our problem happens to be. I can't even imagine how to proceed to try to deal humbly with gluttony, because it's such a central passion of mine. I can imagine trying really hard. Even that probably won't get much result. I'll still be just as overweight next month. But I understand that kind of effort. I know how hard it is to accomplish it in that way. But there is a better way. And I don't know anything about that way, I don't think. Not when it comes to this passion of gluttony. It's a very curious thing. Humility. Humbly recognize that you are powerless. It's like AA or NA, to humbly recognize that you are powerless. And then what? What do you do after that?
Well, you're not powerless.
Struggle. Don't go and eat the chicken, right?
You're not powerless. You might need a little extra help.
Well, that's what they say in AA, right? That you're powerless before this, and it humbles you. And then what do you do after that? You don't go out and eat the chicken. That's not what happens next.
You're powerless once you start eating it, then you're in your passions.
It's that struggle. So I should struggle. Like I did with the pipe that I wanted. I did that. I did well with that. I did. I wanted that pipe. I found a beautiful pipe.
Yeah.
I mean, there are thousands and thousands. You know, I don't even know how many tables there are up there. There must be, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 tables.
Oh,
yeah, I'm individual tables. I'm thinking about rows. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 16, 20. 20 rows of who knows how many tables each. It's like the size of a football field. And every table, and in all of the rows of tables, has hundreds of pipes on it. It takes a real pipe lover to look at all those pipes individually. It takes at least a day of solid 8 hours applying yourself and going from one to another, and just, and you just kind of notice how it's done and how you know what the shape is and what the finish is like and what the technique must have been to produce that kind of a pipe. And I mean, you have to be a real lover of pipes to do this, but people do, you know, complaining all the time that you can't smoke your pipe because you can't. You have to go over into the tent where, you know. Anyway, what I do, almost my method, actually, I've done it more than once, is to find one pipe, the best, the one that really appeals to me. And once I've found that one, and I, you know, I can focus on not buying that one. And none of the other pipes appeal to me. After that, I can look at them, I can appreciate them like that. But the one pipe that I really want, I know is over there. And I'll go over and I'll visit it every once in a while, take a look at it and appreciate it. I know everything about that pipe. I know that pipe very, very well. I'll try to make a pipe of that shape, but I won't have a piece of briar as good and beautiful as that one was. But this, you know, and I, you know, by the end of the first day, the person who made that pipe said, told me, you know, you've had more dates with this pipe than I had with my wife before we got married, you know. So, and then, and I, did I buy that pipe? No, I did not. You know,
and
Jesse,
sold it to somebody else.
He sold it to somebody else. Yeah, and it was gone. He said, and when he sold it to, when did that person buy that pipe? When I was at church. Imagine that. I mean, I'm not looking for a sign here, but I know I don't have that pipe. You know, so that's just, I know about struggle when it comes to buying a pipe, but when it comes to that fried chicken that's in the refrigerator, then it's...
But you don't have any problem with that during Lent.
No, that's different. Yeah, Lent is different. It's like turning off a switch. I don't understand people who have problems with Lent. You're not going to do it. I mean, it's not about the food anyway. There's plenty of other things to struggle with during Lent. The food is the easy part. Why don't do it all the time? Is it the same when it's not Lent? I guess we're supposed to learn that, right? That's one of the things we're supposed to learn. Well, I don't know. Jesse was no help as far as food is concerned. Because he knew all where all the great food was. We ate a bunch of it. So not too successful there. What do you think? How's your struggling going since Lent? Anything. Anger with me. Irritating, frustrating character that I am. You know, and I know I am. I know. Get irritated. Just this afternoon.
That I'm more irritated with other people other than you.
Oh, well, that's something. That's good. Imagine, maybe there are more irritating people than me. Even though we're cooped up day after day, week after week.
Of course, you've been gone for a week, so I didn't have to be irritated with you.
No, that's true. That's true. But then I wasn't back long before I wasn't happy with you. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't that I wasn't happy. I didn't want to do something. I don't remember even what it was. Do you remember? Oh, I know what. I came back Monday, and you went to pottery within an hour after when we got home.
Well, we stopped and had something to eat first, all that stuff.
We did.
We visited.
Visiting is for pipes. Anyway, since we do not recognize pride, and we don't, because we're involved in passions, we don't realize it's pride. In fact, we want to be good, you know, and try to, well, I'm going to really try to be better this month, you know. We don't recognize pride, that being the case. God allows the easily recognized passion to remain. For example, gluttony, idle talk. Most people think idle talk is probably a good thing. They're being friendly. They're not being too friendly about people that they're talking about together, three or four people. you know, men or women. They talk in different ways, but they both do it. Idle talk, anger, and so forth. So we got a problem with anger. Oh, I have a problem with anger. I'm really suffering. And, you know, God, I don't know why he doesn't do something about it. Because it's rooted in pride. You can't see the pride. You can see the anger. You're upset about it, but it's not a good restlessness. It's a bad restlessness. If it were a good restlessness and you wanted to get rid of it for the love of God and not for pride, then you'd get somewhere. So, you know, he leaves it there so that you can have some content to your spiritual struggle and so forth, thus keeping us humble. Maybe, I don't know. Unless we indulge in the anger, then we're prideful.
Well, then you wouldn't be confessing it.
No, well, you might. You could confess it in the wrong way. You know, you might even be irritated with God for not taking it away. When we become repulsed by our passions, this is the problem. Later on, he talks about how when we're young, or when our passion is particular passion is young, you can pull it out like a little weed in the garden. But once you get older, it gets stronger. It's like a root that has become a rooted as thick as a small tree. Pulling it out is not so easy, you know. When we become repulsed by our passions because of our constant falling and recognize our weakness, we can't pull it out, but we have to try to pull it out and want to pull it out, desire to pull it out. The problem is, again, when you get older, it becomes well-rooted. You love the passion. You don't want to get rid of it. You enjoy the passion. You enjoy indulging it. And you say, okay, I'm proud. You may even love being prideful. You may think pride, being prideful, is a good thing. Look at those people out there who have no pride in themselves. This is a common attitude. You know, you should have more pride in yourself. How can you live like this? Well, if this is your condition, if you believe that pride is a good thing, then what are you going to do with these passions that are rooted in pride? You're in a lot of trouble. So, I can't stay away from this particular sin of mine. You confess it, and it's clearer to you, at least, that it's a bad thing, and so God leaves you struggle with it. Except you're not struggling with it. You love it, and you enjoy it. You're just in really bad shape. You have to become repulsed by it. Once we're repulsed by it, we become humble, and God will help us if we make the effort. But you're still going to have to make an effort. It's not. There's no magic here. You say, "Oh, well, it's so disgusting. I didn't even want to think about it." And boom, God takes care of it. Nope, that's not it. You become repulsed, and now you struggle, and then he will help to do. And you have to do everything that you can. That's the practical reality of the spiritual life. Then he will help us to climb the spiritual steps, two at a time. Top of page 30. Passions are uprooted easily when they're still tender, as we just said. I'm going to jump into the middle of this first full paragraph. Passions. And now three down lines down. Passions, when they grow to maturity, harden. And it is difficult to take hold of them in order to uproot them. And jumping down about four lines. If you neglect them, your soul will be overtaken by various desires, and it will be difficult to be delivered from them. Those who do not manage to uproot their passions early on suffer quite a bit in their old age because they grow old with these passions, which become old maladies, old bad problems. Mal means bad, so it's a kind of old bad condition. You know, maladies, sicknesses, illnesses that are difficult to heal. As one grows older, he begins to love his passions. Now you're in trouble. Maybe some kind of shake-up, recognizing in shock the consequences of some passion. And you know, that might shake us out of it. God will let that happen. And of course we'll say, why does God let this happen to me? Well, there's usually reason. And one becomes even more lenient with oneself. And it's always possible to blame others. You know, when we're lost in pride, everything is somebody else's fault. I've met a guy that I really, really, I liked. He was a very, you could think he was a very unlikable person, but I liked him. I understood him very well. He was an older man. It's my age, you know, a curmudgeon. Curmudgeon. You familiar with the word curmudgeon? What's a curmudgeon? Curmudgeon is
somebody who's grouchy and
complains a lot and yeah. You know, finds fault in everything and just as well. He was very curmudgeonly, and just
bunker.
Yeah, he's a kind. He was a kind of curmudgeon. Yeah, he was. So he's complaining about it, and there are all the things. They're the same things I would complain about. You know, that if I were going to complain about it, if I thought it would do. I know it is not going to do any good to complain about all that stuff. Just going to make you miserable. But I did. I liked him. I wish I had more chance to talk to him. I wanted to tell him things like, look, you know, yes, things are a mess. When weren't they a mess? You know, things always look good when you're younger than they do when you're older. Because, well, sometimes things have gotten worse. You have your childhood and you think things are good and, you know, you listen to people talk about things in a way that makes them sound better than they really are, and you get older and you see through all that stuff and you start to see how screwed up things really are. And then you feel like, oh, things have gotten worse. Well, no, you've just become aware of the same things that aggravated your parents, probably. Okay, one's will is weakened as we get older and our passions become to love our passions. One's will is also weakened, making the struggle against the passions even tougher. And I have to say this, even though Sharon and I are 70, because you're much younger, so I will say this for your sake, Stephen. A young person, that's you, so even though you don't, may not feel quite as young as you used to, a young person is full of vitality. If this vitality is used for uprooting the passions, spiritual progress is assured. See? So you're potentially in better shape than what we are. Big if. How will we be delivered from the passions? Why do I constantly fall into the passion of gluttony? You wrote this book for me, I think. Because that's where your weakness lies. The devil attacks the weakest outpost. He doesn't strike at the well-fortified ones. There are things that I don't have difficulty not falling into. They are not my problem. You know, the famous introduction to the Ladder of Divine Ascent, Lazarus Moore talks about how we don't get credit for our natural virtues that just kind of are no effort. We get credit for struggling with the passions that are difficult for us. The weakest outpost has to be the most fortified. We have to make the most effort at where our weaknesses lie. We have to make the most effort to avoid them instead of just falling in love with them and indulging them and then confessing them when we do them and not making any serious effort. We have to fortify those outposts, those weaknesses. And there's not going to be some kind of mechanical quick fix either. People do that, you know, try to make it less available or something. Well, it can help, I guess. Don't fill your refrigerator up with fried chicken and cookies. No, that's not a good idea, because you're going to struggle against it, and that's probably not the way. You must become overwhelmed or become faint-hearted. With courage, examine your passions one by one, starting with the strongest passion. And at first, you shouldn't be too scrupulous going through them with a fine-tooth comb, because why? Because you're going to end up this huge list of passions, you know, and you're going to miss the one that is most major because you're trying to start with the strongest one. So a big laundry list of just almost every passion that is possible, as people have come to confession sometimes, that, Father, I think I've committed all of, you know, broken every one of the Ten Commandments in spirit, you know, haven't killed anybody, but, you know, there's anger and, you know, and all that kind of thing. I mean, if you have all that, what are you going to work on? They're saying, I'm a hopeless case. God forgive me. There's nothing I can do. No, pick out the thing that needs to be done. This is the way we fix things up around the house, or get the things done that need to be done, clear our desk, or do the things that need to be done around the house. You need to pick out the thing that needs to be done most. You don't work on your surface of your floor. If your roof needs to be replaced, you replace the roof first. You need to figure out what needs to be done first. At first, you shouldn't be too scrupulous going through all of your passions with a fine-tooth comb, trying to get every little nit, you know. You know, have these really fine nits, you know, for what do they use them for, combing little bugs, lice. You know, you want to get every little lice. I want to confess every little nit, every little lice. You know, I go to confession.
Egg.
Yeah, that's not the way. That's not the way.
On your hair from the lice.
As the roots of the greatest passions are incapacitated, the finer roots of the smaller passions will also dry out. Pull out the bigger one. The little ones that are down there will die. Actually, some plants aren't like that, but you know, probably some passions aren't like that. I know one, and that's despondency, which comes up in this other book, but you know, we'll save that for later. Garanda, why is it? I make many decisions to struggle with zeal against my passions, but I don't follow through with them, with my struggle. I don't follow through with my struggle. And he responds, this is because you make too many decisions all at once, like making this long list of every single nit, being a nitpicking, a scrupulous person, because you're not actually working on the major thing. You need to figure out what that is and work on it. It's because you make too many decisions all at once. The passions, like the virtues, form a chain. They're related. They're linked to one another. One passion, page 32, is linked to another passion, and one virtue is linked to another virtue. So you want to get hold of the one that once you, you know, are working on it, the others will die once you've dealt with it. So if you decide to struggle for some time to uproot a particular passion and cultivate a corresponding virtue, you will succeed. By uprooting that passion, you will also be delivered from other passions, allowing for the corresponding virtues to be cultivated, which is where this book that I brought in comes in. And there are two other volumes, of course, before this one. But this one, volume 3, is where they make a list of the passions and the virtues. It's called Therapy, Part 5 in this book. Part 5 is Therapy of Passions and the Acquisition of Virtues. Okay, so gluttony. What do you oppose gluttony with? The virtue temperance. Be temperate in your eating. You want to eat a whole chicken? You can't just say, I'm going to be temperate, I'm only going to eat a half a chicken. No. It's a, you want to eat a half a chicken, go have a piece of chicken. Your body only needs one piece. I mean, if I can only have one piece, forget it. I'm not interested. That's a glutton, right?
Mm-hmm.
You, Steve is nice and slender. He doesn't understand this.
I eat more than I should. I know I do.
But we understand it, right? Mm. When it comes to what?
Yeah, I understand it quite well.
Yeah, who wants that? Well, let's have a little something.
It's always at the end of Lent, when Pascha comes, I'm always saying, now you've been good all Lent, you've not eaten any meat, do not go in there and eat every piece of meat that you can stuff into your body and go back for seconds and thirds.
Right.
You know.
And then go to a party and start it all over again.
And start it all over again. And then, you know, and I say that, and then I start eating, you know, I say, you can have a little bit.
Go through the line once with a little bit.
Yeah.
And then the second time.
No, skip the second time.
I've done this, and I've mentioned this to people. There have been Paschas when I have successfully not eaten everything. And do you know, afterwards, when all the food is gone, so what was the matter with you? There was all that food, and you just ate a little? You know, and so there's this voice in the back of my mind that tells me that, you know. And it works that way with other things, too.
Yeah, but no, it's just that it works for, like this year, it worked pretty good. As I stayed under control for about half a bright week. And then all of a sudden there was like, well, we got to keep this, got to get rid of this, you know.
I think it
start
works.
Eating more and more.
It works with a lot of these.
And now
passions.
I just.
Looking at beautiful women. In airports.
For years and years, I've eaten too much.
Right.
Learning to cut back to what I really need.
Yeah.
I already have an overblown idea
of what you really need. It is amazing how little people actually need.
Yeah.
You know.
I
can get by with a lot less than what I really need, but I really think I can. You know? So
I have schooled myself not to just gaze at beautiful women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm pretty good at it. But even though, and they're everywhere, you know. And I notice somebody, I immediately, avert my gaze, look somewhere else. And do you know there is still that voice in the back of my mind said, "What is the matter with you?" You know, just like the food. You know, it's like a different voice almost. You know, and it's a, "Boy, you blew that." You know, "Do you realize how gorgeous she was?" You know. But I don't have a problem with that. But the food, that's a whole different deal. I mean, we have different passions and so what do you deal with when it comes to lust? The cure, the opposite is continence and chastity. Continence and chastity. Well,
So don't keep looking and don't keep.
No.
And don't. Look again and again.
No second look,
and no long, real long one. First look.
That's true too. That's true too. I mean,
Remember, I was at the bowling alley one time. We're in Seneca, South Carolina, and Clemson College is near there. You know,
mm-hmm.
College age girls can be really pretty.
Some
walked in, and I'm looking and I'm praying at the same time. Lord, help me not to have any wrong thoughts about these girls.
But this woman
this woman that I'm staring at, and then I realized, oh yes, Lord, help me not to, help me not to look at these beautiful young
women. After you turn away, you're supposed to.
Yeah, well, I'm crying while I'm looking at that.
Yeah, this is because you have, if you turn away, then you've struggled. Then you can ask for help.
Right.
But you don't. If you're staring, you don't get to ask for help.
Right.
Because you're already indulging yourself, right? Lord, help me stop eating this chicken before I finish the whole thing. Probably not going to happen.
No, you have to remove yourself from that.
That's
just take that chicken and just take what you need on the plate. Then you've already started the struggle.
Well, yes, the struggle. It's getting from the indulgence to the struggle. That's the difficult part. And just confessing the indulgence afterwards can be struggle free. I did this again. I ate the whole thing. You know, there used to be a commercial. Can't believe I ate the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I've done that many a time.
I thought it was a sub sandwich kind of place or something. Can't believe I ate the whole thing. It may be other restaurants more than just that.
Love of money and greed. What do you do with that? Non-possession and almsgiving. So the point is, and he'll talk about this specifically, the thing that you can really do is that makes a difference is to oppose whatever passion you're struggling with. Your struggle will consist of opposing the passion by the opposite virtue. There's got to be an alternative. And distraction, people think distraction is turning to distraction is what's going to help. And this book gets into it. When it comes to acedia, despondency, distraction will not help. Turning to distraction to deal with despondency is giving in. It's running away. It's now you're supposed to struggle against the despondency, and it's difficult. Despondency is especially difficult. I should probably read that part. It's just for, Therapy of acedia. Unlike the other passions, acedia, despondency, cannot be healed and replaced by one single virtue that would be specifically opposed to it. All the others can, but not despondency. St. John Climacus teaches, each of the other passions is destroyed by some particular virtue, but despondency is a general death. This characteristic necessitates a multiform therapy, multiform, many different ways of opposing it. As St. John Cassian stresses, whoever longs to compete legitimately in the contest for perfection will struggle against this pernicious spirit of acedia on all sides. For this passion is known to lack any motive. Why do I feel like this? There is no motive for despondency. And thus, to be often unconscious or incomprehensible, its main effect is to blind the intellect and darken the entire soul. Whoever wishes to fight as is fitting must be swift to purge this disease out of the recesses of his soul. A lot of it is recognition that it's what it is and not something else. In other words, if we're saying, why do I feel like this? Why am I so despondent? There need not be a reason. Abba Pima notes, if man recognizes this passion for what it is, he obtains rest. So recognizing it for what it is helps, and not to be diverted by thinking, what is the reason for it? There may not be a reason. That's part of it. And it can appear in different ways. When acedia appears in the form of a tendency toward drowsiness, it is fitting to resist it by striving not to give in to dozing or to sleep. An attack of acedia should not be avoided by flight, but resisted and overcome. And it seems to me, as I looked at this business of not avoiding it by flight, he talks for a while about if you are a monk and you are in your cell, what you probably are going to want to do is, oh, I'm despondent, I'm going to go and visit some of the other monks, I'm going to go visiting, get together with some of the other monks, and it's a diversion. You haven't dealt with it. You've run away from it. That's a problem. The adversary will assault the victim who has run away from it, tried to find some diversion, more often and more severely once he knows that a person will turn his back on it, run away, and sees that he puts his hope only in flight, not in victory or resistance. Elsewhere, the same saint says of those attacked by acedia, if they concede themselves the freedom of going out often, these monks who are in their cells and should stay there and struggle, they will bring a worse plague upon themselves by this remedy. The source of the healing of this illness is to be sought in man's relationship with himself. And there's more stuff in here about it, but that's the core of it. So it is a particularly difficult passion. Once you recognize it and do something about it, as long as it's not just distraction. There are always a lot of things that need to be done that deserve your effort. Sometimes I say, I'm just tired. Sometimes it's true, and I'm not sure that it really justifies it, frankly. Because the day will come when I'm going to be tired all the time, because I'm going to be 85 years old if I make it. And I think the struggle goes on. You can't just say, well, I'm tired and can't struggle. I think you still can. You need to learn how to do it. Therapy of sadness. Now, they make a distinction between sadness and despondency. Sadness, what is the virtue that contends against sadness? Joy. Now, achieving joy as a virtue in order to get rid of sadness is, I think, more difficult than opposing gluttony by temperance or lust by chastity or greed by almsgiving. It's a more difficult one, it seems to me. Anger you oppose by gentleness and patience. But struggle, don't just rely on your own willpower, because if you do, chances are you're going to start to resent the people that you've been gentle and patient with. So you struggle and then you ask God for help. You don't struggle and then bring it to a conclusion by just bearing down and just putting up with all of these troublesome people. Therapy of fear. The fear of God. The fear of God. The fear of displeasing God, of becoming alienated from God, of being absolutely alone and without God. It means without meaning. Some of us don't have a good experience of that, but others of us have more. Therapy of vainglory and pride is humility. Well, we know that humility is opposite of pride. And he gives you some examples. There's a therapy for vainglory, there's a therapy for pride, and then he talks about humility. So there are ways to oppose these things. Mainly it's a matter of recognition in most cases. There's no pill. So I thought that would be appropriate, since he's talking about cultivate a corresponding virtue. So we want to cultivate those virtues that are mentioned. It's going to be difficult because we're in the grip of a passion. So I should cultivate what?
Temperance.
Temperance, exactly. Temperance. If you decide to struggle for some time to uproot a particular passion and cultivate a corresponding virtue, you will succeed. By uprooting that passion, you will also be delivered from other passions, allowing for the corresponding virtues to be cultivated. So this struggle is essential. That's what it's all about. If we're not struggling, then we're just posing. We're just posers behind our beards. Abba Isaac said, dispassion does not mean that one feels no passions, but that he does not accept any of them. So is it sinful to feel a passion? No. What is sinful is to accept it. You accept it inside of yourself, and then you may or may not act on it outside of yourself. But it's the accepting, and then worse yet, the action after. We don't have to confess that. Now, of course, if you're a monk, you're on the lookout for thoughts, and you confess your thoughts. But confessing our thoughts, it's more intense than spiritual life is going to be for most of us, because we're not monks. We live in the world. And believing that what we really ought to be doing is trying to clear out everything inside of ourselves internally, it's like arrogant. You know, there are things that we do that we ought not to do. Focus on them. Focus on them. And besides which, most priests are not spiritually adept enough to offer us counseling with that kind of confession thoughts. I try to encourage people to confess the things that they have done. Gratitude toward God, page 33, first new section. Gratitude toward God is not enough. It also requires, now as far as struggling against the passions, gratitude toward God is not enough. It also requires a good disposition, which we don't always have, you know. Acknowledgement of our sinfulness and a philotimo-filled asceticism. Philotimo, philo, friend. I had a scoutmaster. I was very fortunate when I was a boy to have a scoutmaster who was a history teacher. He taught history in college. He had three boys and he loved them very much, and he was just the greatest scoutmaster anybody can imagine. If they made a movie about an ideal scoutmaster, they would have to have my scoutmaster in that position. His name was Fred Schlick, but everybody called him Fido. In fact, he encouraged them to call him Fido because he said Fido means faithful. That's why we called dogs Fido, because dogs are faithful. So we called him Fido, but we had a great deal of respect for him. You wouldn't think somebody, you know, that you call Fido, you would have a great amount of respect for, but it's Philo, friend, Fido, faithful. Philo means friend, Fido means faithful. So being faithful to your friendship with God. Fear of God is fear of losing God's friendship, fear of losing the love of the person that you love. If you have fear of losing the love of the person that you love, you understand that, then you can understand the fear of God. Because it's fear of losing God's love and your love of God even, because you're going to lose the love of the person that you love. That's a terrible fear. And the second part of philotimo is timo, and that means honor. The honor that you maintain as a, and we could reach back to a previous book, remember that Christian friendship is a matter of the two people together cultivating purity of heart. And so there's a faithfulness to the purity of heart. The honor that we are cultivating is the honor of purity of heart. And philotimo is about remaining friends, having a friendship in common with those who are cultivating purity of heart. And God incarnate, Jesus Christ, is the center of that. So that's what philotimo is all about. Sometimes people want to take philotimo and give it some kind of prideful, worldly understanding. Well, it meant that before there was Christianity. You know, but this is Christian philotima. You know, selfless love of the welfare of others is one of the direct definitions. Philotima. Removal of ego from every action. So it's a Christian nobility. Philotima for the sake of Christ. If I should die right now, given that standard, how will I be judged? Or do I have a contract with death? That's the alternative. Okay. Oh, this is especially good. We don't want to miss this one. Right in the middle of this paragraph, just about. We will be judged for the sins we have committed and not repented for. Okay. So that's how important repentance is. Page 34. Now I'm going to start in the middle of the first new paragraph. When a person exerts effort to excise, to cut out, one of his passions, the evil one will present obstacles, so he feels pressured. Just like a possessed person is pressured when the prayers of exorcism are read for him, because there is an ongoing battle. He is fighting with the devil. However, in the end, he is liberated. So if we let ourselves off easy, this is what we're letting ourselves in for. Friendship with the evil one. Cleansing our inner self cannot be accomplished without effort. Top of page 35. Here's where this quotation is, middle of this first paragraph. Is there anyone who wouldn't run to help a small child trying to roll a big rock with his little hands? This is how God also works. When he sees your small effort, he will help you overcome. Small effort. It's a big effort for us. But compared to what needs to be done, it's not so big an effort, but we have to make it. Otherwise, he's not going to help us to roll that big rock. Middle of the next paragraph. For God to help, one has to make every effort he is capable of. Every effort he is capable of. We can't just say, oh, I wish I weren't like this. I wish I hadn't done this, you know. No, you have to make an effort, every effort that we're capable of. End of the paragraph. No person can ever be helped if he doesn't want to help himself. And Sharon has written in here a quotation from her mother, something her mother used to say a lot. Of course, it wasn't original with her, but she used to say it a lot. God helps those who help themselves. And in the best, as Father, as Elder Paisios would say, in the good sense. It's not a prayer for thieves. It's something else, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know how she took that, but it seems to me that she may unwittingly have to say something
profound
that she didn't realize she was saying, you know.
No, could be. Could be.
She was trying to keep you from being...
to get up and do something. Yeah, well, it's good advice, though, right? Yeah, God looks at it the same way. For God to give, we must sow. How will God give if we do not work? God will provide abundant rain to soften the soil, but we must also cultivate our field. Got to break the ground. The earth is ready, but we must put our hand to the plow and sow our field. And whatever we sow, we will reap. But if we do not plow, how can we sow? And if we do not sow, what will we harvest? Page 36. We should not only ask what God can do for us, but what we can do for ourselves. What can I do? The Bank of Christ offers great interest rates, but if we make no deposit in his bank, how can we expect to make a withdrawal? So the next time, part one, self-love, the source of our passions. We'll start on page 39, chapter 1, self-love and its consequences. Okay. Any final comments either of you would like to make? Steve said he underlined some things, and I just ran roughshod through the whole section and didn't give him the opportunity to talk about them. Would you like to bring one of them up? Pick out the best one.
Yes, Yolanda, this on 33.
Okay.
Yolanda, does the remembrance of death help in this inner work? Yes, it is very helpful. If we bear in mind the remembrance of death with hope in God, we will become aware of the vanity of this world and be helped spiritually. This is why we should keep the criterion judgment of God in mind and not forget that we will be judged for the sins we have committed and not repented for. What am I doing? What am I doing? How can I live with so much negligence? Should be our thoughts. If I should die right now, how will I be judged? Do I have a contract with death? Death comes both to the young and the old. If I could keep in mind that God may call me soon, then I would not be so inclined to sin. For the passions to die, we must keep death in mind, think of the future judgment, and be ready to suffer ourselves out of philotimo?
I think so.
For the sake of Christ, who suffered so much to redeem us. The struggle against the passions is a perpetual sweet martyrdom of observing the commandments out of love for Christ. It is better to die heroically than to be overcome by the passions and wound Christ.
One of the things that it's good to remember is that the part of us that is meant to die, having it die, it's only terrible from the point of view of the love of the passion.
Yeah.
Once it begins to depart, there is a sense of a weight lifted, a greater freedom, a joy, a peace, all those things come as a result. It's not a morbid thing, it's a positive thing. Although the enemy will try to convince us. The enemy and our ego, and they're very closely aligned, they will try to convince us otherwise, and are very good at convincing us otherwise. Now, if I could apply that to gluttony, who knows what might happen. I'll try to work on that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.